and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the replica 16th century sauna that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we hit our 50 episode milestone, and I feel like I can finally do something I've been wanting to do for a very long time, which is hit my big red hype button. Yes.
I'm glad you finally found a use for that, Jeremy, other than just sort of playing it in my ear when I'm trying to work.
This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the merits of art school, robots making art, and the potential impact algorithms may have on art and creativity. Helping us ring in our 50th episode and bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, Jeff Hamada. Jeff is a Japanese-Canadian artist living and working in Vancouver. In 2008, he created, as I like to say, boom,
boom.
But just boom. Boom, spelled with seven O's, which quickly became of the largest art blogs on the internet. In 2015, his first book, Remake, Masterworks of Art Reimagined, was published by San Francisco-based Chronicle Books. Jeff now spends a lot of time creating things for brands and has worked with the likes of everyone from Adobe to Uniqlo. I almost got there from A to Z, but there was no client ending with Z. So,
almost.
I got very close.
A to Uniqlo is pretty good.
He's also spoken on the topic of curation, creativity, and community building at creative conferences all over the world. And today, we are so glad to have him join us on Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys for having me. I wouldn't say I'm a longtime listener, but after Laura showed it to me, I've been an avid listener, so I've been going through the archives. So good job, you guys. Really great podcast.
Well, that's our favorite kind of reaction. Jeff, it's so funny because you and I met, I don't know, almost 8 years ago or something now, when we brought you out as a speaker for Carbon Festival that I was working on back in the day, and then reconnected just recently at Powwow. And so much has happened since then. And it's so awesome to be sort of having you here, you know, now all these years later. And big thank you.
And it's nice to come full circle because we, you know, discussed Boom and the membership program that you were offering in the podcast a few episodes ago. What episode was that?
We'll put it
in the show notes.
Sometime within the last like 10 episodes, yeah.
I know, but we're coming full circle. Now we have Jeff here as well, which is just, it's very meta. I'm loving it. So let's get straight into our first link of the week. And Laura, what are you doing surfing the American side of the web here, bringing us a link from the AIGA?
I'm allowed to leave the Australian side of the web sometimes. So yes, this does come to us from AIGA's Eye on Design blog.
And AIGA, we should just clarify, the
American Institute of Graphic Arts.
Yes.
That was beautiful, Jeremy. We should harmonize next time. Yeah, I think this is actually fast becoming one of my favorite places on the internet for industry news and think pieces. It's really good. So the question that they're asking here with this piece is whether animators really do need to go to university or whether you can get an equal or perhaps even a better education from online resources alone. And I think we can sort of extend that question to artists and creatives of all sorts, not just animators. So the writer here, Liv Siddle, she spoke to five fantastic animators to get their thoughts on whether or not their time spent at art school was, you know, imperative to the career that they have now, or whether they could have sort of quite easily acquired the same skills online. And the responses are interesting, although probably not that surprising, really. The one that I definitely resonated with most came from Isaiah Saxon, who's the co-founder of the animation studio Encyclopedia Pictura, who do some awesome stuff. And he writes, "Nearly all disciplines can be learned effectively in an autodidactic way on the internet, but that requires a particularly self-directed person. The only reason to be in college for any artistic discipline is to be in a structure of immersion with a group of peers that becomes a self-feeding loop of excitement and support to rapidly improve. If you're able to create this environment at a young age outside of school, perhaps with an online cohort, then it's fantastic. But it's really rare and special that these young groups find the conditions to thrive outside of college because of the intense demands of capitalism and the steep cost of housing in cities today." I mean, I always love anyone who goes on a bit of a rant, but I did sort of resonate with that. And the next bit that I really loved was he says, "College at least gives you a framework to live in a fake world, shielded from those realities as you accrue debt that you'll be paying off for 20 years. Clearly he's in America. But the most important skill there is, which cannot be taught but only nurtured, is the ability to geek out and follow your passion. School structures often work to separate you from that inner fire. So in some sense, it stifles the only important thing. But if you can find a school environment that lets you follow your nose to learn just what excites you, it can be worth it. And yeah. I thought that was really interesting. Clearly, he's a bit bitter about the school system. But what about you guys? Jeff, I know that you studied new media at Emily Carr University of Art and Design, or film and new media, rather. So what are your thoughts on this?
I think I, based on reading what he said there, kind of had probably a similar experience where I was kind of half and half on it. Like, I've in some ways had a negative experience, but I really benefited from the people there, as opposed to, I think it was one of the people interviewed, Sophie, said something about how I don't think degrees are meant for learning software. And I think all my sort of takeaways from being at art school are more based on sort of the environment of having a lot of people with vastly different views from me, views on like what creatively, what was interesting, what was worth looking at, making me have to sort of question what I thought was good. And I think you could perhaps do that outside of school, but you'd have to be very disciplined to like want to hang out with essentially people that you wouldn't naturally be drawn to, which I don't think is most people.
And keeping in mind, you're like sort of maybe 18, 19 at this point, like what 18, 19 year old is that disciplined?
I'd say for most people, they kind of need someone to be forcing them to do a lot of the things that would be required to get the value out of that. I think most people are more comfortable hanging out with people that are similar to them and to spend every day. I think a lot of the actually most helpful things were critiques where before I went to Emily Carr, I did a couple of years of fine arts at another college called Langara College. And we had critiques where actually in a creative writing class I took were the best, where they're anonymous. You would have to read out your story in front of everyone. I didn't realize this going into the class, but I thought I could just get some easy credits, like writing a few things, and then it would be kind of an easy thing to offset some of my fine art classes. But the first day we had to write something, finish the piece, and then come back to the class the following week and stand up in front of everyone and read it out. So I was like mortified by that, but I did it. And then everyone in the class would sort of fill out this little critiquing form that they had, and then anonymously you'd get this stack of papers from people, and some people's feedback was not very helpful, but other people in the class were actually really amazing writers and actually offered some great criticism. And I'd say like that system worked a lot better than when some of the critiques I was at Emily Carr, where you'd stand up and show your work and then people were more being sort of graded also on the way that they critiqued your work. So it kind of became this competition for like showing off all this like art speak you could do about someone else's work. And it ended up ruining a bit of the, I think, like what a good critique can and should do.
Yeah, I think that's a common sort of complaint about art schools, that it becomes a lot about art speak. Jeremy, what did you study? Where did you go? What did you do?
Oh, man, sorry, but like this piece wound me up so much. And like talking about school, it's kind of like, you know, one of those toys where you pull that really long string and then it's just going to go. I could probably start now and talk for the next 45 minutes just about this, because it's so interesting as well, the kind of mix of people that we have recording right now, because I think the American system is so different in terms of how they approach education, especially higher education. And I think a lot of the thoughts in this piece reflect that. And I think, well, Australia and Canada being Commonwealth countries and a bit more, you know, have a much different approach. And so I think we inherently have different attitudes. But for me, actually, I started my higher education in America and actually finished it in Australia. I actually kind of dropped out of art school where I went to at Pratt Institute. I just have so many thoughts about this. I'm interested in this whole idea of how these tools are now available online where you can educate yourself in a much more real way than when I went to school. And so I think a lot of the points that are being made here are great. I think one of the biggest aspects of going to school that I found positive was the social network that you create that eventually becomes your first professional network. And that was the reason I, you know, started Jackie Winter, because like at the time that I ended up in Australia, all of my friends that I went to art school with were now becoming art directors and commissioning work. So it has these kind of social and professional kind of benefits there that are really hard to quantify. But the insane cost between $30,000 and $40,000 a year that families will save up for a lifetime to send people there is a lot of burden to place on someone 18 years old or 17
years
old. Yeah,
and that's where it is a very different thing. I'm not sure what the system's like in Canada, but it's a very different thing studying in Australia. I think my whole degree cost me like $15,000 and I haven't even started paying it back. It's like still yeah. a loan that automatically comes out of my pay once I earn a certain amount. And if I never earn that amount, I never pay it back. The system is completely different. And so that does obviously affect you. I mean, it's much more accessible to go to university here.
But there's a totally different, I mean, just the way it's done though is so different. Again, this is just a huge difference in the population, because there's this whole idea of this rite of passage where you leave your home, you typically go out of state, you live in a dorm, you have this completely different social experience, where here is kind of so much different. Like, you could still live with your parents, or you're in the same place that you
Yeah, I lived
up.
At home the whole time I was at uni.
I just kind of think that what's happening now, I mean, especially what the tools that Boom is offering, for example, like that kind of is creating these social networks as well, like just through kind of Slack. So I think, and things like Holdframe that they bring up, which is something that we discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago. Yeah, these tools kind of are there, which can kind of replicate that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when I think about my experience, there are some of my favorite times in art school were doing nothing to do with what my degree was. I started actually in graphic design, then switched to film, and then went back to graphic design. But, you know, just doing life drawing for 6 hours a week was one of like my favorite things. And I still kind of, I still think that kind of taught me more than anything that while I really valued and wanted the kind of software experience, it's kind of those things that weren't really, that I didn't know were related at the time. Right now, more than anything, what I wish I could have 4 years to go back and do that. And that's why I think Tim Ferriss, who, while he does have lots of questionable ideas and things, he does have that kind of thing that he did, which I forget what it was called, like his self-directed MBA, where instead of kind of taking the 120 grand that he was going to invest in other businesses, invested in himself and did this thing. And I think Seth Godin is doing that now. So I think this idea of, you know, time and our attention being kind of this huge luxury, and how you can put it towards education later in life is something that I'm really
I think
kind of
you touched on something
about.
Really interesting there, because I've had quite a few friends go back to university now, you know, after however long working in their industries, and they are getting so much more out of the system because they are really focused and really engaged, and also not really participating in the sort of more social aspects of uni because everyone there is 10 years younger than them. So you're like, you don't want to go hang out with an 18-year-old when you're in your 20s or 30s. And that's kind of interesting. I think perhaps you can actually gain more from tertiary education once you've got some context to apply it to, once you've already had some kind of industry experience. But I think that could be, you know, we could say the same for actual sort of brick and mortar tertiary education or online courses and things. Like, I now get a lot out of doing sort of various, even if it's like lynda.com stuff or whatever, because I have some commercial real world context to apply it to.
I think, yeah, one thing what I want to wrap up and hear a bit more from Jeff about is also this idea that, well, especially in America, I talk about this a lot with illustration, you end up generating work of what your professors are, you know, and so you get these very kind of homogenized little bubbles of kind of certain kind of styles, and that can be very geographic. I was just talking about this recently, where it's kind of like America has this real kind of editorial style, because a lot of illustrators teach illustration, or editorial art directors are teaching, you know, that's how they need to make up their income.
And it's also what's heralded as the sort of the golden level of illustration is being in the New Yorker, being in the New York Times.
But then on the converse of that is, like, you know, you look at what we call the It's Nice That style, like, you know, where everything in the UK kind of looks a certain way as well. I mean, Jeff, as someone who kind of has so much different visual work kind of filtered through you, that, do you notice any kind of geographic trends at all?
I think I can definitely see a bit of what you're talking about with the, I guess, with regard to like this nice, that style, if there is something UK-centric versus maybe a more of an American editorial style. I don't know, though. Like, I guess sort of a question that I always have floating around in my mind about my site is whether it continues to be something of value if the danger of site sort of dictating style or directing where it will go, I think, is in the homogenization of styles and the idea that someone, you know, in Mexico or Japan or Canada or in the UK are all watching the same movies or seeing the same few artists posted on these sites. So I have, I guess, an inner conflict about thinking about the voice of the site and how much it will affect what people go on to make. And also, I wanted to talk about the idea of Holdframe, and like you guys mentioned it earlier, just the idea of someone offering, I don't know if we have to talk about what the site actually does. I haven't actually used it, but seeing the demonstrations of being able to take apart someone's project and see how they made it, I really identify with that way of learning. I actually weaseled my way into electronic arts as a graphic designer, even though I was taking film at school. And I ended up having to sort of pretend I knew what I was doing, sort of like George Costanza at a job, like acting like I was working there. And the one way that I actually learned my job was asking for the previous person's Photoshop files, just to see like how they, I didn't even know how to put stuff into like layers or folders or use adjustment layers and things like that. And our director early on would be like, come to my desk and kind of freak out on me that I wasn't really delivering any of the things I was supposed to be doing. And I kind of just leveled with them that I didn't really know what I was doing. And I was like, if you show me one time, like, I'll nail it. And he's like, okay, get your tablet out. And I didn't even know what that was. He's like, where's your Wacom tablet? I was like, he's like, you're doing all this work with a mouse. And it got me at that point that like no one had even given me a tablet. And but then he ended up being like super fluent in Photoshop and really knew what he was talking about. So I remember just trying to take in the little things he was showing me on the computer, wrote notes to myself, and sort of learned in a backwards way. And I think that it's kind of similar to like the way kids growing up now are listening to music that is actually references to old music or samples, or watching movies that are all references to old movies. And we're sort of, our culture is now one of like a backwards learning, where you're like learning the latest version and then you're only later finding out about the original one. I actually feel like there's more like a homogenization of like styles and stuff. Like I'll see work that someone is made in a country that really looks like that UK style, and they don't live anywhere close to there. And I can tell what artists they've been looking at. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think in some ways it's an inevitable thing. And so just trying to figure out like, what's the point, or what's the messaging from our side, or how do we help creative culture when that sort of, I guess, one downside is just that people looking at a smaller and smaller pool of work, what the outcome of that is. And I don't fully have an answer other than I don't want people to just spend all day looking at my site. I'll be sad if people just say, oh yeah, I love your website. I spend like 8 hours a day on it and I don't do anything else. It's more meant to be like an appetizer where, you know, you'd look at it and then you get excited to go do your own thing. And then you spend most of your time doing that other thing. And I think there's sort of, people need to find some sort of balance at what point they're going to stop looking and taking in stuff and start producing. And like sort of the input and output balance, I think, is important.
Absolutely. Well, look, that's a really interesting perspective, Jeff. And again, I think if people aren't familiar with your site, we will put all those links into the show notes. And I think we'll move on to our second topic from here.
Jeremy, you're number two. Hit us.
I will not hit you, but I will get my robot friend to hit you, maybe, with art.
That was so seamless, Jeremy, and this will make way more sense once you tell us what your link is. Or maybe not.
My link is, look, I was going to make a plea to Fast Company and say, hey, you know, we are giving you guys so many shout outs every week. I mean, we could make
the Fast
Company
we're making
podcast
a huge dent in their readership, Jeremy.
Well, I just found out they actually have announced they have two podcasts kind of coming out.
And now you've just promoted their podcast as well.
I love it so much. I tried to kind of get away from this link, but I couldn't. It's a really short one. The Fast Company piece is just a bit of a gateway drug into the depths of robot-made fine art. And, you know, this piece is, you know, it says a glimpse into the uncanny world of robot-made fine art, and kind of goes, the main link here is really to this prize or competition called Robot Art. It's not a really great name.
The website is glorious.
It's very interesting because I had to do a bit of digging to kind of find out who was behind it. And it's all from a non-for-profit that is run by a guy named Andrew Conru. And he's
a bit of digging. That's like the first thing they say in the Fast
really?
Company article. Are you kidding me?
Oh my God.
Like the first sentence is a quote from Andrew Conru.
I want to tell you something that you might not know. I read my articles from the last paragraph up. Seriously.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's how I go through all my content. I start.
Why?
Because I find.
You make me so angry, and you listen to your podcast at like six times the speed.
Yes, I have a very strange way of.
You're
of
ruining
content.
All the content that people spend hours crafting for you to consume. Oh my God, you
anyway,
make me so mad.
Andrew Conru, CEO of the Friend Finder Networks. I don't know if you know his most popular site, Adult Friend Finder, which
Jeremy,
was.
Jeremy, why would I know that?
I don't
why,
know.
Why do you know that?
I don't know. Well, because it says in his Wikipedia entry. Yeah,
I've seen the pop-ups.
It's interesting. He's taken his fortune. He has a non-for-profit and they run this competition every year. And basically the job is to see kind of what AI or what kind of robots can emulate painting. And I'll just read here verbatim here on their about page of why painting. Basically, they say that the skills required to effectively paint are intrinsically human: graceful movement, sense of touch and pressure, ability to experience color and value. And one thing that I talk about a lot, and I've referenced on a few episodes here, is how when the tools, especially for photography, were democratized into everyone's kind of phone, having a high quality camera, how that really kind of impacted and devalued the commercial photography world and how it's become much harder to exist there as an artist. And I think, well, this is going to happen with illustration and visual art in kind of some way. And we've talked about previously, Laura, you talked about CryptoKitties and other ways art has kind of moved on the blockchain. But what these bots are doing in the robot art is actually kind of creating work. And I think the more you kind of go into it, the more this goes so deep. And I think I would love to point out specifically the Cloud Painter site, which is just one guy, basically. And he was the winner of the 2018 contest. He actually sells his work under commissions. He has kind of original commissions that range from $200 to $800. And then he's also got these fine art pieces. And he's got this piece for $20,000 called Crowdsourced Lincoln, which I think is just really cool, where he hooked up the robot to a community where everyone kind of vied for control of the robot's arm, and eventually kind of someone just did tic-tac over the face of Lincoln. Again, this podcast is an enhanced podcast. So if you're listening to this on one of the supported players, you'll be able to see exactly what I'm kind of talking about. But yeah, I think one of the things that I'm always kind of thinking about is how this is going to happen. Google only 2 years ago released something called QuickDraw, which was a way that they actually worked with artists, a lot of amazing vector artists, to kind of draw tens of thousands of different objects, and then with their AI could recognize a simple sketch and then give you the vector representation of that object. So it's already kind of happening in small ways. And I think artists really kind of need to kind of be on top of this to prepare their own practice kind of for this, because it's very real. So I'm really curious to hear Jeff's perspective on this. Again, you know, Boom has been such a major platform for which new art and aesthetics have kind of arisen from, for better or for worse. It's played an active part in that. Jeff, looking at some of these pieces that won, if you didn't know these pieces were created by robot, do you think they would merit a second look? Like, what's your take on this aesthetically?
I didn't find any of them that interesting. So regardless of whether they're made by a robot or not, they're just not something that personally interested me. I'm, I guess, interested in connecting with other humans as opposed to connecting with a machine. Whether or not I can tell the difference, I guess, is another discussion. I think at this point, a lot of people would be similar to me, but I was just reading about people in Japan who are having relationships with digital avatars. And I think like a guy in Korea famously married a pillow. So there's obviously people who may feel differently.
That was actually Jeremy.
But I think like we're actually having a similar sort of a related discussion when we made this post a while ago about Google Pixel to the XL phone. Someone was comparing it to this like $20,000 Hasselblad camera. And the sort of the crux of the video was, you know, I guess like in a clickbaity kind of title, they're trying to get you to see whether or not the Google phone is as good as this Hasselblad. But sort of at the heart of the discussion was really a philosophical one, which is like the Google Pixel using their algorithms or using like pixel splitting or all these technical things I don't fully understand, but they're essentially creating the lens blurs that like a nice expensive piece of glass would do for creating bokeh or the nice soft focus backgrounds. Mm. And so the question is really like, does it matter to people whether mathematical equations are being done to create that look or whether the glass itself is actually the reason why the photo looks like that? For me, in the short term, I don't really care how something's made, because so much of what using those sort of technologies, it still requires a human hand at this point. But I think eventually, as less and less human involvement is necessary, I think it might be something that I will be more concerned about, because I would like to be looking at stuff that's made by humans. I don't really have a personal interest in some sort of self-generative thing that has no human involvement at some point and just continues to make and make on its own. I think I've always tried to curate the site, whether it's photography or visual, like fine art or paintings and drawings, that all has, I guess, like evidence of the human hand. I like imperfect work. I like drawings where you can see little mistakes or little things that like a robot or some sort of AI wouldn't have chosen to do unless it was programmed to exactly imitate what a human did. So I think those little imperfect qualities about things are actually what I find the most interesting. And I think it's similar for people that like enjoy listening to records or things that just have these little crackles or things that make something feel like it has soul or something. And I guess eventually it's going to become indistinguishable where these computer generated ones are identical. So at that point, I don't know, the value will be really just something where you're either being tricked. Like I think eventually there'll probably be, I guess I could see one where humans continue to use whatever the next Photoshop is or whatever that's enhanced by AI, and it'll be sort of used as like an assistant for a human hand still. And then there'll be other people who use it to make computer generated art that pretends to be something that humans made in an effort probably to like have a cheaper alternative to hiring a really well-known artist. And then I guess the third column would be AI that's making art completely on its own without any sort of input from a human, and not for the sake of imitating or copying or ripping off someone's work, but some other realm where I guess robots are just making art for themselves. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it's that consciousness that there's, we sort of talk about, is distinguishing the difference between art created by humans and art created by robots. I think, you know, one of the main factors that goes into why and how people appreciate fine art is not just the finished product itself, but what it is that the creator experienced, interpreted in order to produce that piece of art, right? And I think at this stage, we're viewing this through the lens of the fact that, okay, well, the computers are not doing that, but perhaps one day they are. In, you know, there is a day where the computers are interpreting things that they're being fed and drawing emotional conclusions from those things and creating art based on that, and which is crazy, but I don't think it's that far-fetched necessarily.
Well, look, this piece came off the back of Westworld season two kind of finishing up, which raised a lot of these points, and it was one of my favorite shows. And I think, yeah, it really got me thinking. But that's an interesting point when you differentiate between fine art and applied art, where like a lot of these pieces, and
that's what I wanted to talk about.
I would agree that a lot of these pieces aren't that kind of thrilling on the face of it, again, because it's kind of in the painting mechanism. That's why I would really encourage anyone who looks at these links to actually dig a bit deeper into the creators in each category and kind of look deeper on the site, because especially the
Cloud Painter.
Yeah, there's some really aesthetically pleasing things on there. But also, it's like, if you look at what a lot of these bots are doing right now, they're taking a style of like an old master, for example, and they're having input kind of fed in, and then using that style as kind of a codified,
they're imitating it.
So if you look at, like, especially a lot of the advice we give,
so are most humans, right?
Well, a lot of the advice we give illustrators and a lot of the kind of briefs that we get from commercial clients, like, they already kind of know what they want before they want it. And like, there's a very small window to kind of have that spark of kind of newness. It's like, and when you're presenting a folio, there needs to be kind of consistency around it. So if you could somehow put into words or kind of put into input what your style was and have that kind of then executed by something else, is that a threat or is that an opportunity? Laura, do you have any kind of final thoughts on that at all?
I had a lot of thoughts about this. If we're looking at just the competition itself and not yet thinking about any of the sort of potential broader implications for the, you know, creation and existence of artists and art as a whole, well then, yeah, I think this is a really cool competition. Like, just in general, I love the idea. It's a brilliant thing for robotics students to be able to work towards. And it's great to see a marriage between something very scientific and something very artistic, as it's not often that these two things are so clearly intertwined. And also, most of the prize money goes to charity. And overall, it's just a really interesting idea. But now, if we want to look at things in terms of sort of machines versus real life, flesh and blood human artists, they make a point in the article that no matter how intelligent machines become, human viewers will always respect human artists more than machine ones, the same way that human chess grandmasters elicit more admiration than computer grandmasters. Mm. And I think, yeah, perhaps that is all well and good for fine art, where that sort of thing is known and is documented. You know, I mean, that there is already very clear evidence of just how big a role the creator of an artwork plays in its perceived value. So I don't think that's necessarily in danger there. But when it comes to commercial art, that is not necessarily the case. I think if these machines get to a point where they're able to generate art that we think is objectively good, and the differences between human and machine art are sort of imperceivable, then when you're in a situation that is driven by financial capitalistic factors like advertising, I don't see why sort of art generating machines wouldn't sometimes take the place of living, breathing commercial artists. I mean, I hate that, but, and also I have to be clear, that's not to say that the art directors and producers commissioning commercial artists don't have a huge amount of respect for the craft and wouldn't choose to work with humans in many cases. But yes, I do think when we consider this scenario, we are hindered by our current understanding of machine-generated art and find it really hard to imagine a situation where the art being generated by a machine feels just as good or original or moving and creative as a piece by, I don't know, David Bromley or Murakami. But, you know, sadly, I think that progression, if you want to call it progression, is kind of inevitable. And it's a long way off, but I don't think really there's any technological advancement that we won't one day master. And the way that our world is going, cheaper and faster always wins out. And I definitely don't think that is the case for fine art. Not at all. I think that will largely be unscathed. Or if anything, it might actually be more heralded. But for commercial art, who knows? And I guess the point here is that, you know, it's not necessarily that these tools are better than human creators, but the thing is that these tools are already pretty good now and they're only going to get better. Like there are tons of apps you can already use to transform like photographs into hand-painted artworks, you know? So you have to ask the question, like if all the client needs is a camera and an AI image rendering app, why would they bother employing the services of a professional artist? Well, of course, think that they absolutely should for a multitude of reasons, partly because my job would be rendered sort of obsolete, but it's plausible that one day artists and art retailers will be selling their services based on authenticity, like, you know, spruiking like 100% hand-drawn pictures. You know, perhaps one day that might be the only visible marker that separates human artworks from those created by machines. And I'm really depressed now.
Well, what did we talk about a few weeks ago about how that, you know, in graphic design, especially those kind of cues of kind of fake authenticity and how they're kind of used. And I think, yeah, like all of that kind of authenticity can and will be manufactured. So the line's getting thinner and thinner. I, for one, welcome our new robot. I'm sorry, I just had to end on that one there. But yeah, no, some real fascinating content in here. Really great to dig into it. I think there's some amazing kind of short-term and long-term implications here. But I think, yeah, it's up to all of us as creatives like to keep on top of this stuff.
So. And fight the robots.
And we will move on from there. And finally, our last link of the episode comes from Jeff. Jeff, I was a bit surprised to see a podcast for your link. I think this is the first kind of actual kind of audio link that we have. I'm curious as well, before you tell us a bit more about this link, I mean, this is a question that I'd like to ask everybody on the show, especially interested to hear from you. Like, where do you kind of get your links from? Do you do RSS or are you kind of finding stuff on Twitter? Like, what's your kind of drug of choice for getting that content in you? And where did you find this one?
Well, first of all, I'm against RSS. I'm against things that feel endless. I hate endless scroll. I like feeling like I get through a list of things and I'm done. So I actually...
But isn't that exactly what RSS is though? Like, that's why I use it, because like it puts the number of like articles there. You go through them and then you're done with that site until tomorrow.
It's true, I guess. But I think what I also dislike is any sort of inbox or thing that I have to like get through a certain little number of like how many text messages I haven't opened or emails, and RSS sort of reminds me of that. So I think like probably if I break it down, RSS is probably a more efficient way of doing what I do, is essentially just go through a million of my book. I still keep things in bookmark folders and stuff. I can't remember who first put me on to Reply All. I've been like a listener from the very beginning. I used to listen to a podcast called Radiolab, and I was a huge fan of that show. And then
we're big fans here too.
I gotta admit though that like I feel like it hasn't been as interesting as it was when it first started. But anyways, that's a whole other thing. But the person, I think some of my friends were really into it, were talking about it, and I was asking for other recommendations, and then a couple of them I think had mentioned Reply All. So I started listening to it. I knew that this link was not directly related, I guess, to a creative theme of the podcast, but I saw some interesting sort of links to like what your links had been like around algorithms and sort of AI.
So yeah, tell us what the episode is about.
Yeah, so essentially it's, I guess, uncovering the sort of shady side of Amazon and whether or not people had noticed that Amazon had become a little bit shadier in the last little while. And they sort of reveal that it has to do with allowing third-party vendors to be listed on there. And I personally had an experience where I was trying to buy a FireWire adapter to hook up an old digital video camera to my new computer, and I needed a very specific adapter. So I looked for it on Amazon, and there was one I think that came up for $20, and then there was this one that came up for like literally I think $3 or $4, so cheap. And I knew that it had to be, you know, coming from China or something like that. So I was like, I'm going to spend, you know, $4 on this thing, because even if it doesn't work, I only spent $4 on it. So I bought this thing, and I think I waited like a month and a half or 2 months with nothing coming. And then I wrote this message complaining to them, you know, like, where's my package? I ordered this thing. And without even any sort of attempt at customer service, they just immediately refunded my money. And then the package came. So I realized, I'm not going to condone sort of ripping off these people, but there is sort of a strategy here where I realized that these companies don't care about customer service. So you potentially could always find these third-party vendors, make orders, complain about them, get your money back, and still get the product, because they're not going to waste any time actually talking to you. I don't even think they even sent me any personal email. It was just like instantly money hit my account. It had been refunded and they didn't apologize or anything.
I've actually had similar experiences, although not through Amazon. It's interesting that we're talking about Amazon, because Amazon only launched in Australia like, what,
a couple months ago.
Year? Like, oh, yeah, crazy. Not. Yeah, which is crazy. I mean, we've had access to Amazon, but like 99% of the products on there like don't ship to Australia. Yeah. So we've had books, but no one buys them from Amazon anyway. So it's funny because every movie I watched, every sitcom, every podcast I listen to that's, you know, produced in North America, they talk constantly about how Amazon is just this ubiquitous sort of behemoth that everyone relies on for their whole lives. It's such a weird concept to me because we don't really have the equivalent here. But they do sort of touch on this in the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I got from the episode is that everything used to be sold by Amazon, and then they opened it up to third parties. And then that's kind of where all this gaming of the algorithm could be made, where you could just pretty much rip something off and then
fake reviews is the big thing. Yeah.
Fake reviews. And I'm going to kind of come at this a bit sideways with something else, but I'm kind of curious, Jeff, how this links to the creative world in some ways. Because you were mentioning that, I mean, algorithms rule everything in terms of especially platforms like Instagram, but you know, you mentioned even Artsy, that it could kind of get into and influence it.
Well, yeah. So like, I guess the other part of the podcast is they're talking about how sellers started to realize that the more reviews they had, the higher up their listings would be. So if you search for this FireWire adapter, if they had enough reviews on the product, it would appear higher. So people just started paying people to give 5-star reviews on stuff. So there's all these people that make a living just giving perfect reviews on these products. And essentially, yes, gaming the algorithm. And there's another article I could send it to you guys to include it in the notes. People were actually finding like bestsellers on the book list. And so say it was something like Hunger Games, they would use something that I'd never heard of before, which is a synonymizer, which would synonymize the book. So it would take all of the Hunger Games and change it into another book with all similar words. And I think they would post it on a Friday, and they would use bots to like purchase this fake book. And then enough human people would see it and they'd start to buy it, and it would hit the bestseller list over the weekend when the human curators are off for the weekend. And so these fake books would hit the bestseller list on Amazon's system like over and over and over. And they were books that were just ripoffs of like ones that, you know, were legit bestsellers.
I'd almost be amazed if I received one of these fake books. Like I kind of love to read one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was like another example of people sort of finding a way to game an algorithm and figure out like, oh, if this means this, then I can do this, and a lot more people will see my thing and I'll get sales. And I think it's very related to how people use, say, Instagram, where you share some of your work and then it doesn't really get that much action. And then if like you share your work, but with a pencil or pen in the image, which is what some artists have told me, whenever they share images where their pencil or pen is in the image, a lot more people comment and engage with it because they won't usually want to know like about the tools or what kind of pencil it is. Or James told me that many times where he's like, I'll intentionally include a pencil if I want more engagement on it. He probably won't appreciate that I said that. But I think it's sort of touching on something where it's obviously people care about how much people engage and like their work. And for artists who sell work online, that's directly related to whether or not they can survive doing what they're doing. So they're going to try to some extent serve the algorithm and make things that the algorithm actually will be kind to them. And so I think in some ways, people are starting to change their art just for the sake of the way that it will be shared, the subject matter, whether their work is like too dark and not friendly to even Instagram's policies of what they'll show, nudity, etc. I think there's ways that already algorithms are really dictating what people create in hopes of trying to make sales directly through it. So I think that there's a direct correlation to the way that people are sort of abusing the Amazon system or finding ways around the way it works that are very relevant to the way people are using platforms like Instagram, but also a site like Artsy potentially. I don't know anything about it, so what I'm saying here is just my own opinion. But if a site like that where, you know, they're potentially selling people's work and having data on, you know, the most sellable artwork, like people like the color red and they like an abstract painter versus a representational one, and all these sort of stats that over time they could essentially put together a list of what will be the most sellable artwork on their platform. And I think Shazam's the same way, where Shazam, you use it to Shazam a song, you hear a song, you like it, and the app can tell you what song it is. But not only at the end of the year, they're going to have a list of the most Shazam songs, but they're going to have data on the most Shazammed part of the most popular song. So they'll say like, oh, this Drake song, people always Shazam it during this part. And they'd eventually be able to manufacture pop music based. They're probably already doing it, to be honest, based on data directly out of Shazam, because it's what people want to hear. So I think if you were to take data like that from Artsy, and just why would an artist not want to have that data and know what more people are going to buy? And I think that's kind of a scary idea.
Well, it's an amazing flip side of what we were talking about before in terms of using AI to create art, but using AI and data to create art in a completely different way. I mean, mm-hmm. if you plug those two things together, it'd be crazy. I mean, man, algorithms are fucked. It's really, really interesting, everything that you're saying there. And I think so much of our time, especially with our marketing, is now kind of, well, not kind of what content we're going to actually put out there, but like, how are we going to kind of get people to kind of see it? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. Like, there's another link I want to kind of post that Bianca actually sent to me, which it was called The Death of Don Draper, and saying advertising, once a creative industry, is now a data-driven business. Mm-hmm. Relying on algorithms, and how the implications are deeply sinister. It's going to get you to, definitely a great something to get you to read. But yeah. I've seen this happen. A friend of mine, kind of as an experiment, played lots of kind of right-wing racist videos on YouTube, like as an experiment. And then all of a sudden, all his advertising on the internet, all the other videos he was kind of seeing, were all this escalation kind of that content. And mm-hmm. this article talks about how YouTube is a radicalizing instrument because the stakes are always kind of being up. Like, you know, someone kind of researches something on vegetarianism and now you're being showed a lot of things about veganism. Not to kind of equate those two mm-hmm. things at all, but just like it's always, you know, stepping it up. It's really problematic.
One thing that this raised for me, I remember we have a Slack channel that's all of our artists on the Jackie Winter roster. And I think it was Mark Martin, hi Mark, who posted a link to a Tumblr post by Seb Lester, who is a letterer basically on Instagram and does some really, really meditative videos of like, you know, his stuff garners a lot of likes. But basically, he had just completed this project that had taken him like, you know, several days. And it was a project he worked sort of really, really hard on, and it sort of didn't get a huge amount of likes. And then he, the next day, recorded himself basically drawing the poop emoji on his iPad. And in like less than 24 hours, it went like completely viral. And it was just this kind of, he wrote this Tumblr post. He just said like, you know, I'm terribly confused. Last week, I spent 3 days slavishly drawing a pop culture icon in a piece of art that was meant to be a celebration of Celtic, medieval and Renaissance ornaments. I was attempting to highlight the parallels found in celebrity and religion in terms of worship. I drew on some of the most refined and ingenious expressions of ornamental design in our collective history. I rendered the piece lovingly in a style reminiscent of 18th century metal engraving, blah, 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 blah. And then yesterday, in a bit of frustration, I spent 3 minutes drawing a poop emoji and uploaded it onto the internet. In less than 24 hours, it's reached over 500,000 fucking people across my social media and received over 25,000 likes. People seem to love it. My mate Dave says it's the best thing I've ever put on the internet. I guess what I'm trying to say is I just don't get it. And Mark sort of raised the question to our other artists. He was like, have you guys had the same thing where there's something that you've worked really hard on, people just don't really care, and then you draw something that has like a cat in it and people go crazy, and does that affect the kind of work that you make? And I think you have to consider as well, like, I mean, it's very easy to sort of be like, well, what kind of artist would let that sort of stuff influence their creations? But being an artist is a job as well. Of course, it's something people do because they want to express themselves and share out with the world, but it's also a job, like a, you know, commercial artist and fine artists. It's something that they do to make an income, to make a living, to support themselves and their families. And so it's important that the work is appreciated, and getting more likes, getting more followers does up the value of your work. And so you can't sort of blame these people sometimes for maybe adjusting their output based on this sort of stuff.
Yeah, but you never know. I mean, it might be that the initial piece that he did, someone who's actually going to kind of maybe commission him, like, might appreciate that a bit more, and that might have, you know, more of a financial benefit to him in the end.
Yeah, but now, like, so many times, you know this, when people lost jobs because someone doesn't have enough of a following, and no matter how right they are for the project or how great their artwork is, a client wants someone who's got, you know, a million followers on Instagram. And so that kind of stuff can really play into your finances.
We shared one of Seb Lester's videos on our Facebook. He didn't follow that many people, and I noticed that he was following Boom, so I reached out to him sort of early on, and we posted one of his videos and it got 36 million views on Facebook. It was like, whoa, by far the largest thing we've ever shared. And it wasn't a poop emoji thing. It was actually just like his skillful calligraphy. So I think his work actually, it's funny. I mean, he's being a bit tongue-in-cheek, I'm sure, but his work actually is something about calligraphy that resonates with a wide variety of people. So I think he's in a good position to not have to dumb down the thing that he likes and still have people like it, because he happens to like something that there's obvious craft involved, and this, you can sort of do things that are a little bit more virally that don't feel that far out of the realm of what he's doing. Like, he can draw the Netflix logo or different famous logos, and kind of that's his version of clickbait, but it's still showing off his talent. So I think he's sort of fortunate in that sense that it's not that far off from what he already likes to do.
Have you noticed anything, Jeff, on content that you post for Boom? Like, you know, get certain engagement. Are there any kind of tips or tricks that you can share with us? Because we would love to know.
Well, something interesting was a while ago, we proposed sort of a way to combat what Facebook was doing with their algorithm. And I won't name any of the partners. We had a bunch of sites who were down to do it. There are a lot of sites that are very similar to what we do in some respect, or arts and culture sites. You can probably guess who most of them were. But so the idea that we came up with was, if we just every month share our top 10 links with each other, and we each choose one of the links to share on our own Facebook page, and then we all sort of make a commitment to interact with those posts on each other's pages, because each one of our sites individually had several hundred thousand followers, we should be able to push posts more reach than they would get on their own, and sort of like break the algorithm. So it actually worked really well for a while. And what we found was some of the other sites that perhaps had more people working on them than our teams, it's quite small, and I wouldn't say we're more passionate about it, but it seemed like the people that we were dealing with didn't care as much about like making sure to interact with other people's posts and doing these little detail things. Because in the end, we pushed other sites a lot more traffic than they pushed us. So it started to sort of fall apart because people weren't sort of being diligent on the little aspects of it. But I think it was an interesting experiment to see, like, you could actually team up with other people that all had their own followings and on a schedule sort of routinely break through the sort of reach algorithm setup, because there's just so many people that followed each page that it was a way to sort of game the Facebook algorithm.
Which I think circles back really well to what some of these sellers are doing on Amazon totally. In terms of, yeah.
Jeff, thanks very much for bringing that to us. We will put the link to that in our show notes, which everyone can find every week at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. It is time for drum roll, please, or that, please. The brilliantly named Thumbs Up / Thumbs Down, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the completely petty off our chest. Why? Because nobody else will listen to us. Lara, what do you have for us this week? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
So, shock, horror, I am doing a thumbs up for the first time in a very long time.
Hit us.
I know. I complain every single week about public transport, but this week... Well, I forgot to think about it on the way to work. So I am going to give a thumbs up because I've only just discovered Glow, the Netflix show. I mean, I can't say discovered, but like I've seen the ads for so long and I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I finally started watching it and I have consumed like all two seasons in a minute. And it's so good. Everything about it is so good. I love Alison Brie. The costumes are amazing. The dialogue's amazing. The characters have dimension. Jeremy, don't roll your eyes at me. It's so freaking good. You watch Westworld, that second season, blah. I don't want to have to watch a show where I have to then spend 3 hours Googling it afterwards in order to
That's
understand
That's the best
the plot.
Part. That's the best part. Anyway.
Nerd.
Okay, good one.
What about you?
Jeff, anything from you this week? Is anything that you would like to air or recommend?
I was going to do, should I change my mind? Okay, I got a thumbs up. I got a thumbs up. Fortnite, which is the most popular game on the planet right now, and I have to really admit that I'm a nerd and I'm like really into it. And
what platform are you playing on?
This will truly show how nerdy I am. I have a PlayStation. I was playing with some friends, and then other friends were playing on Xbox, and I actually went and bought an Xbox so I could play.
Oh god.
And
because that's the thing, like when you go into a squad, like you have to, like you're only with other people on the
totally.
Same platform.
Well,
isn't
you
that
can
right?
actually the yeah. thing is you can actually play with PC. The only things that don't like each other are PlayStation and Xbox, and it's because Sony's dumb and they just don't want to play nice with Xbox. But everyone else can play together. Like Nintendo can play with Xbox, Nintendo can play with PC, PC can play with Xbox. Like there's every other platform can talk to one another, but PlayStation will just not let Xbox and PlayStation. And it's like on Twitter, like Microsoft and Fortnite
I feel like
are like
turned into a thumbs up.
No. This is like a thumbs up because I find the game so interesting. Well, for one, it's a completely free game and they're making like, I forget how many million dollars a day, but it's just on people buying like skins for their characters and stuff. And I really want to see games like this succeed because previously, I don't know how much you guys play video games, but there's been a lot of games. EA got a lot of sort of bad rap for having games where essentially it's pay to win. Like the more money you pay, the more chance you have of getting these better items that actually make you better. Whereas this game it, regardless of whether you spend $1,000 on it or zero, you have a level playing field. And they're really only making the opportunity to purchase items that don't actually affect gameplay. And they're doing so many interesting things in the way that they market the game and the way that they're like really, I guess, supportive of people on Twitch. And Twitch is sort of, I don't know, this is another whole discussion about how a lot, like, YouTube's really afraid of Twitch. And they're having a lot of people, even outside of gaming, really move off of YouTube to other platforms and using things like Patreon. And so in a really weird way, I could convince myself that I'm playing the game as research for my website. But I'm going to just admit that I like the game for what it is. But these other things sort of really interest me because they're making so much money off this thing and you don't have to spend any money on it. And I think if you can figure out what something like that looks like for other, you know, areas that are not video games, I think that's a really interesting thing to look at.
That's a really cool point. And Jeremy, when I play Two Dots on my phone, it's it's research for work, I promise. Jeremy, well, thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you got?
I mean, I do, like, part of me wants me to give a thumbs down to Fortnite because like I have watched like over an hour of tutorial videos and I still can't figure
really
it out.
Tough.
But I'm going to bypass that. I'm also going to give a thumbs up, sort of related, but this is literally hot off the press. Just came in through our Slack and it's about today's Supreme drop in New York, which is, I think, yeah, the newspaper. Insane. Like, just like, if you want to talk about an amazing innovative company, they bought a front page ad in the New York Post and it wraps around the paper and it's just kind of the Supreme logo on white with the New York Post masthead and the sports masthead and just like how people have been going nuts, like just emptying out newsstands for it. Like, it's just genius. Between that and the brick and everything else they've kind of done, like, it's just gone beyond, I think, something that is commercially successful as well as an amazing kind of art project as well in kind of so
people
many
are
ways.
Buying the
so,
ad, essentially. Crazy.
Oh man, this works on like so many levels. It's just so genius. So massive thumbs up to Supreme and kind of, you know, everything that they're doing and whoever is behind this one especially. I think that will do us for this week. Jeff, if people want to find out more about you, more about Boom, what is the one-stop resource or handle on the net where you can be found?
It's pretty much Boom everywhere. Just Boom with 7 O's. So BOOOOOM. So it's on Instagram or boom.com.
I mean, was it like, did you just keep hitting O's on like GoDaddy until you got the domain or?
I did think of it just as a logo first. I was doing graphics at the time. And so there was sort of a method to it where it fit nicely into a 3x3 square logo. So I happened to register that just as a joke. And then it actually ended up being one of the only amounts of O's available. Like, I think like 8 was maybe also available, but like everything leading up to it was already taken. And it was just a really stupid joke that I never intended for it to be anything. So it was kind of a really random choice.
But I still, I don't know why I haven't just like bookmarked things, but I go to Broom multiple times a week. And every time I'm like, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Somebody who owns the other ones, and like, are they kind of like, are people kind of like setting up weird kind of link farms or anything on any of the other O's? You know, like how if you mistype Google, like someone makes.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think if I was smarter early on, I would have tried to buy the other ones. But people at the bank were really annoyed because they have to count the O's on like X and stuff, and then eventually, like, people would just all know me when I went in there. They're like, "Oh yeah, we know who you are." And so I think like
it's all worth it if you can piss off the bank.
Early on, people told me it was a really stupid thing to choose because no one would be able to get there, but it always sort of raises an eyebrow when I say what it is or have to spell it out and people want to know what it is. So I end up talking to people about what it, like, it gives me a reason to sort of tell someone about what it is.
Amazing. Well, Jeff, thank you again for your time. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter Gives You the Business, archives of all of our shows and the links we covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram, Gaming the Algorithm, at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes. And of course, recommending us to all your mates. As well as iTunes, they can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the traditionalist directly from our website, which is, again, jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see links to the articles we're talking about, as well as other Schmick visual content as we wrap it on. It's like right in the room with you. And if you work for an advertising agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. So much work kind of filters through your eye and through your side. Have you noticed any kind of geographic, you know, differences, especially you have a Canadian perspective close to North America, I mean, close to America as well, and between UK and illustration? I'm going to start that over again.